Hi, everyone. It's me, Diane Jenks, the Outspoken Cyclist. I'd like to take a couple of moments to thank you for your support in 2018. It's been quite a year of cycling news, information, conversation, and reviews. With the holidays coming up, I hope you find some time to listen to the show and to get some time for yourself to go out for a ride or two. I'd also like to remind you that the Outspoken Cyclist podcast is a listener-sponsored show. And to those of you who have shown your support with your donations, I am exceedingly grateful. It makes all the time and effort that goes into each show worth every minute. For those who are new to the show, and if you like what you hear each week and find the show worthwhile, won't you please consider making a small donation? There is a special donor link on my blog, OutspokenCyclist.com, that allows you to choose either a set amount or input any other amount with which you feel comfortable. The link is secure, and the payment page will take you to either PayPal or a credit card button. Once again, that link is www.OutspokenCyclist.com, and the donor link is at the top of the page, in the menu section, as well as on the sidebar. Lastly, to all of you, please know that I appreciate your interest, your feedback, and your encouragement. Going forward into 2019, I will continue to work hard to bring you the best conversations that I can, and I hope you continue to listen to the show. I'd like to wish you and your family a happy, healthy, and peaceful holiday season, and thank you for listening.
Time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for November 10th, 2018. With the midterm elections finally behind us, I guess it's time to refocus on what's now in front of us, the holidays. We're only 2 weeks away from Thanksgiving, and already there are holiday decorations, holiday music, and of course the big holiday discount that almost every merchant on the planet is offering. So how about a gift that is free? Would you like that? Well, there actually is such a thing, and tonight we're going to explore something you actually do get for nothing. Although, hopefully your participation is not worth nothing. I think that's right. People for Bikes has been doing some great work, and from their launch out of Bikes Belong in 1999, looking for 1 million people to sign the pledge to put more people on bikes more often, to their numerous initiatives, grants, legislative wins, and a website full of resources, the organization asks only that you offer up your name and email to stay in the loop and be part of the growth of cycling. Tim Blumenthal, president of People for Bikes, joins me to bring us up to speed on some of the newest tools and resources available to all of us. It's a free gift for your holiday. Then after a break and a couple of news items, I speak with William Bevington about his long-awaited book, Japanese Steel, Classic Bicycle Design from Japan. The beautiful hardbound coffee table book is exquisitely documented and photographed following the peak export years of the Japanese classic steel bikes from companies such as Bridgestone, Nishiki, Fuji, Panasonic, and Miata. William and I discuss the export trade organizations, the Shimano and Suntour differences, and much more. We really only scratched the surface of the contents of the book, but I think it will wet your whistle. So let's head on out to Colorado first and speak with People for Bikes, Tim Blumenthal. Hi, Tim. Welcome back to the Outspoken Cyclist. Seems like it's been a really long time since we last spoke.
Yes, I think that's right. And I'm glad that we get the chance to talk again.
Good, good. So we're heading into year end. You know, I like to speak with the leaders of advocacy organizations, especially those that depend upon folks like my listeners for their support. People for Bikes has grown a lot in the past few years. How is membership today? What kind of growth have you seen, especially in 2018?
Well, we have so many different ways that people and companies can get involved, but I guess some of the key metrics are individual supporters, people who have said, I believe in what you're doing and you can contact me. And that membership or that statement of support is free. People just give us their name and email address. And we have about 1.28 million people who have done that.
Wow.
That's great. And what's even greater is that probably a couple times a week, we conduct campaigns where there's a local alert. We'll pick a place where there's something that's either controversial or promising, or it's a bond issue, or it's a legislative issue, and we'll send a targeted email to everybody in one city or one county or one state. And we've had very good luck, very good support this year. People respond to those. They get bombarded by emails, but they open, read, and often respond. And that response, you know, when it's measured in the hundreds of responses or thousands, influences elected officials and other decision makers. So that's gone well. Our support from companies that make bike stuff is solid. Foundation support is good. Really, we have all different kinds of support. Never enough to help us achieve everything that we want to do, but it's solid.
That's excellent. So what are some of the areas People for Bikes is concentrating on for research and development right now?
We have a project that's called Places for Bikes that is actually supported above and beyond by Trek. And what it's all about is helping cities improve their bike infrastructure of all kinds, not just point A to point B, not just protected bike lanes, not just multi-use paths, not just mountain bike trails, all of it, and network it. And so to support that project, we created a couple of new things. One is called the Bicycle Network Analysis Tool. And basically, it's a map that shows, and you can do it for 500 cities in the U.S., just about any mid-sized to big city. It will show you where the low-stress bike riding is and where the high-stress bike riding is. And it is helping city leaders figure out where to concentrate when they want to improve bicycling. Because if on the map it's red, it means it's high-stress. If it's blue, it's low-stress. And the low-stress is what we want. And we want it for kids, we want it for seniors, we want it for everybody in between. We want it for recreational riding, transportation riding, mixes, everything. And so that tool has really helped us. And then we created a city rating system, a new one. You know, we were always and still are big supporters of the League of American Bicyclists and their Bicycle Friendly America city ratings. And we were asked to create a different kind of rating. And we did. And I think the best U.S. city, which is Fort Collins, Colorado, gets somewhere between a 3.4, 3.5 out of 5. So there are no 4-star cities, no 5-star cities in the United States. And I can explain to you if you want what we evaluate, but it's really worked out well.
What is it you're looking for that would take a city like Fort Collins from 3.5 to 5? I mean, what is missing?
Yeah. Well, 5 is daunting. I don't know that there's any city in the whole world
okay.
That's a 5. And we're trying to be tough graders, but we measure 5 things. We measure bicycle use, so participation. We measure safety. We measure the completeness and quality of the bike network, which is, you know, what we were talking about before when I was talking about the bicycle network analysis. And then we measure two more things that are really interesting. One is the pace of growth, how quickly the city is making progress and what their commitment is in dollars and plans to improve. What's their timetable? Because as I think we all know, this stuff tends to happen a little bit too slow, or I shouldn't say a little bit, too slow, period.
Right.
It just takes too long. And then the last is what we call reach. How well does the city serve the entire city? You know, I think historically, parts of cities have benefited more than others from better bike infrastructure, from the launch of bike share systems, you know, safety improvements, all those things. And we're really committed, as are a lot of cities, to providing equal value and equal service across the entire city. And that's, you know, that's something that hasn't always happened, not just for bicycling, but period, in a lot of our cities. So those are the five categories.
Yeah, that would be a really interesting thing to do in Cleveland, because Cleveland is so sprawling. You know, it has this network of neighborhoods that ring this downtown. So it's very difficult, I think, to put it all together. Those are five interesting things. And I can see how you can approach a five, but you may or may not ever get there. I understand what you're saying now, that nobody's a five. Let me remind our listeners real quick. We're speaking with Tim Blumenthal. He is the president of People for Bikes, great organization out of Colorado, but it serves the entire country. So we are seeing an increase in urban riders. Funding for urban projects often is at odds with the needs of these riders. And there's a piece on your website that talks about budget mismanagement at the state level and how it affects bicycle-related projects. What can you tell me about that?
Well, I can tell you that traditionally, when it comes to bicycling, states have really a mixed record, state governments. You know, state governments have tended to focus on building state highways and have paid most attention to longer distance trips. And that's changing for the positive, but frankly, it's been a barrier. And there are a lot of reasons for it. The one thing I would say is that we're working very hard to get states to recognize the economic benefits of bicycling. And that's not only the bike industry and bike businesses, but it's tourism. We've created actually some new tools to help states and cities and events and anyone measure the economic benefits of bicycling, whether they're a destination, running bike tours, running a small bike business. And we really need better metrics. We need to be able to quantify and measure and not only speak passionately about how, when people ride bikes, great things happen. We need to back it up with good stories and good numbers. And I think that's the future in states. But, you know, the other thing is that there is a rift, I think, between some state governments and the needs of the cities in those states. You know, there's a lot of political tension there, and transit is expensive. Building new highways is expensive. Building bike infrastructure and supporting bicycling, relatively speaking, is cheap. But I think if you asked a lot of state leaders, they would say they're concerned that it's not a good investment because not enough people will actually do it. So that's why it's so important that we show that people actually do it and show that that percentage of trips that switches from cars or transit to bikes makes a difference.
Yeah, it's the chicken or egg thing. We need more people on bikes. We need more infrastructure. We need less people in cars. It's a mindset. One of the other interesting areas that I think you are working on is e-bikes. And so how are they in the mix? What is happening with electric bikes and electric assist, pedal assist bikes?
So in a word, the growth of e-bikes in the United States is an amazing story. And e-bike sales will double this year from last, and they doubled last year from the year before. And everywhere that I go, and I have the good fortune to get, you know, all around the U.S., I see so many e-bikes, so many more e-bikes than I've ever seen. And I think e-bikes are being widely accepted, certainly by people in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s as a way to stay on bikes, certainly by people who don't want to drive to work every day and are looking for a non-sweaty, reasonable alternative for, you know, maybe a commute of 4 to 8 miles. E-bikes, the batteries have improved, the technology has improved, and the laws have improved. And we're the leaders on that. We've succeeded in getting 10 U.S. states to support and approve a three-class e-bike classification that basically recognizes class one and class two and class three. Class one is a pedal assist e-bike where the motor can provide some assistance, but it cuts off basically between 15 and 20 miles an hour. That's the most popular kind of e-bike. And I see e-bikes are likely to continue to keep growing and growing and be widely accepted. And I think there was a time when traditional bike riders said, we don't need this. You know, why can't people just ride bikes? Well, e-bikes have done a lot to break down barriers to entry and to make longer and better bike rides possible. And the simple truth is that the way they perform is not fundamentally different from regular bikes. So it's a really positive story. It's a great story. It's going to probably continue.
Don't you think that it's also a great story for bike shops? It seems to me that there's an area where bike shops can begin to shine again, you know, to grow again and to look at a category that brings in a whole new range of customers again.
Absolutely. And another area of growth there is e-cargo bikes.
Mm.
And, you know, just this is going to be a really big thing. You know, if you're a UPS or FedEx or the Postal Service or a pizza delivery business, squeezing your way through the heart of major city and finding a temporary spot to park and deliver, it's a battle. And if you can reduce your physical footprint and squeeze in and navigate and be quick, and again, benefit from the electric technology, the assistance, you're just going to see in the United States in the next 5 years a dramatic increase in the number of e-cargo bikes. And it's going to be really cool, whether you're carrying kids or dogs or groceries or all three or delivering. It's a big deal.
I guess it's Lyft and Uber both have gotten into some sort of e-bike business, or at least they're about to.
They both have.
Okay.
They've made major investments. Uber purchased an e-bike share company called Jump.
Right. Okay.
And they're red bikes, and they have an integrated basket, and they ride really well, and they're pretty cool. And I'm not sure precisely about the number of cities, but it's growing. And it's good because Uber is politically sophisticated. And they're basically saying we're in the mobility business and that bikes are part of mobility. So that's really good. Lyft purchased Motivate, which is the biggest traditional docked bike sharing system in the United States. You know, they operate the bike sharing systems in New York and Washington and a bunch of other cities. And so to have power players who see the potential, the ongoing potential of bicycling as a point A to point B solution in our cities, that's going to be good for anybody who rides a bike, because it'll hopefully help infrastructure, increase bicycle use. And when you improve infrastructure and increase use, that helps safety.
Right. So the last thing I want to talk about is the politics of cycling. By the time, unfortunately, this conversation airs, the midterm election will be over. It's tomorrow, and you and I are talking on Monday, November 5th. And we'll know what happens in the Congress and Senate and at the state level. What is PFB's focus going forward into 2019 and beyond? And how can listeners participate to show their, you know, interest in making sure legislators hear what they have to say?
First point is that we need to be strictly bipartisan. You know, there was a time, frankly, when most of our support, at least in Congress, was on the Democratic side. And we've worked very hard and very steadily to increase Republican support in Congress, and we've done that successfully. And one of the ways that we were successful and are successful is emphasizing the jobs, the taxes, the economic benefits of bicycling. But I think in terms of people, you need to be community-minded first. You need to be aware of the plans in your community and the leadership. And we still suffer from a misperception, again, that bicycling is a fringe thing, that it's a cultural thing, that only people who self-identify as cyclists can do it. Some people don't see it as a contemporary solution. It's too low tech, not, you know, it's just too basic. And of course, that's part of the beauty and the reason that it does work. So I think being involved locally, you know, we would love people to continue to be part of the People for Bikes Network. And again, that's free. Take a few minutes every month to read our email alerts. Well, we track national stuff, we track city stuff, we track local stuff. I think the future of bicycling in this country is very, very positive, but it's not assured. Because again, there is somewhat of a pushback in some places. So we have to make sure that we message well, storytell well, and supplement that with powerful research. And I'm optimistic.
Well, on that note, I'm optimistic too. I really appreciate you talking with me. We've been speaking with Tim Blumenthal. He is the president of People for Bikes. It's peopleforbikes.org. And the website is chock full of things, ways to get involved, programs that they're doing. And I really appreciate you talking with me. I hope you have a wonderful holiday this year.
Okay. Thanks so much.
All right. Anytime. You take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Tim Blumenthal is the president of People for Bikes out in Boulder, Colorado. You can find out more about the organization and sign up to get all the information if you're interested at peopleforbikes.org. We're going to take a short break. We'll do some news, and then we'll be back to speak with William Bevington about his new book, Japanese Steel, Classic Bicycle Design from Japan. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
Before we get to our conversation with William Bevington, I've got a couple of news items that I think are worthy of mentioning this week. First up is a rather disturbing story from the November 7th edition of the Washington Post. AP reporter Samuel Petriquin wrote in the sports section of the paper about a practice that seems particularly disrespectful to pro cyclists. It seems that the anti-doping authorities are targeting out-of-competition cyclists for testing, and at incredibly inappropriate times and places. The story begins with a Belgian rider who was forced to leave a cycling gala to follow inspectors who came to take samples. Here's what happened. Pieter Seri, who rides for the Quick-Step team, missed the gala of the Flandrian on Tuesday after doping inspectors came to the ceremony to take samples. In a statement published Wednesday, the Riders Association, the CPA, complained about, quote, another case of non-respect for the privacy of the riders, end quote, and criticized the odd timing of some doping controls. Quote, there have been cases reported where the riders were checked on their wedding day, during a funeral, or on their child's first day of school, said Gianni Bugno, the president of the CPA. Now we read about the case of Pieter Seri, controlled in the off-season, out of the hours scheduled, while at the Flemish Cycling Festival. The riders pay 2% of their prizes to make these controls possible. They are the only athletes in the world who pay the anti-doping from their own pockets, Bugno said. The riders respect the measures required for the fighting against doping, but at least they ask for the respect of their private life in return. Belgian media quoted Seri as saying he had already been tested 2 weeks ago and told anti-doping authorities he was available from 7 a.m. to 8 a.m. at his home. Quote, I understand that there must be checks and that people have to do their work, but two checks immediately after each other out of season is simply a waste of money. I feel like a prisoner with an ankle monitor, Sari was quoted as saying. The CPA added that it will try to find out whether it was the Belgian Anti-Doping Agency, the National Cycling Federation, or Cycling's Anti-Doping Foundation, the CADF, which ordered Sari's test. In addition, the CPA will present an official request to all the bodies involved in the fight against doping and the UCI to establish a code of conduct for the controllers to ensure the respect for the private life of the athletes, at least in certain circumstances, the CPA said. I think we should be watching this story. So here's one on a cheerier note from the I Could Have Told You That department. Carlton Reed, who is the editor of Bike Biz in the UK, as well as the recipient of the Press Gazette's Transport Journalist of the Year Award in 2018, congratulations, sir, wrote an article for Forbes titled Data from Millions of Smartphone Journeys Proves Cyclists Faster in Cities Than Cars and Motorbikes. Carlton writes, smartphone data from riders and drivers, schlepping meals for restaurant-to-home courier service, Deliveroo, shows that bicycles are faster than cars in towns and cities. Bicyclists are also often faster than motorized two-wheelers. Deliveroo works with 30,000 riders and drivers in 13 countries. That bicyclists are faster in cities will come as no surprise to bicycle advocates who have staged so-called, quote, commuter races, end quote, for many years. However, these races, organized to highlight the swiftness of urban cycling, are usually staged in locations and at hours skewed toward bicycle riders. The Deliveroo stats are significant because they have been extracted from millions of actual journeys. And that's all thanks to Frank. Frank is the name Deliveroo gives its routing algorithm. The name was chosen for the Danny DeVito character in the series It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Delivering millions of simultaneous orders from thousands of restaurants to hungry consumers within 30 minutes using roving self-employed couriers equipped with smartphones is a complex vehicle routing problem. Consumers want piping hot food, restaurants want meals picked up when cooked, riders paid per drop want multiple deliveries per hour, and Deliveroo needs to make money. The article is quite a bit longer. It gives a lot of information, but one interesting factoid, Deliveroo is now valued at $2 billion. That's with a B. For the rest of the article, you can log on to Forbes.com/sites/Carlton Reed and look for the headline, Data from Millions of Smartphone Journeys Prove Cyclists Faster in Cities Than Cars and Motorbikes. I think that that article ties in nicely with what People for Bikes Tim Blumenthal was saying at the beginning of the show. So let's take a quick ID break and then get right into my conversation with William Bevington about his book, Japanese Steel, Classic Bicycle Design from Japan. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
Okay, we're back. And I caught up with William Bevington at the New School in New York City. Hi, William. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
My pleasure. How are you, Diane?
I am okay. I'm recovering from, you know, the plague. But other than that, I'm just fine. You know, people have been anticipating this book, and it has to be probably the gift of the season for cyclists who love steel bikes.
Wow, thank you very much.
Yeah, I'm really excited about being able to talk to you about it. So the title of the book is Japanese Steel, Classic Bicycle Design from Japan. It's a coffee table hardbound book. Great photos, great information. Let's start with you. Tell me a little bit about your background and how you got involved in Japanese steel bikes.
Well, I can probably do that. It's actually an overlapping answer because I've served as a designer of various types, but various design fields from the outset. And that actually, in some ways, began back in my old Fuji days, because when I was a paper boy, I sort of discovered this one bike shop in Rochelle Park, New Jersey, which was run by Ken Maria. And it was the first dedicated retail Fuji bicycle shop. So I worked there as a kid. And then, amazingly, was able to design the logo, the Fuji 3-dot logo. And what that led to, really, is my discovery of graphic design. And then I wound up going to design school and pursuing design my whole life. But at the same time, I was always interested in vintage bikes. I got down to only one at one point in my life and got up to about 40 at one point in my life. But I've always been a real fan of, you know, these beautiful steel machines. And because I rode mostly in heavy urban areas, they were very suitable for that.
Well, it's interesting that it's Japanese steel bikes, because that is where, of course, anybody who's been in the business as long as I have started. Fuji was that sort of exalted brand, but there have been some wonderful steel bikes. There are still some wonderful steel bikes, and many of them are still on the road today, 40 years later. So,
exactly.
Why do you think a steel bike stands out from, say, a handmade bike today? I mean, there are a lot of artisan steel frame builders today.
Yes, probably more than the past in many ways, or at least more dedicated at the extremely high levels, because obviously it's become something of a craft, right? When technologies shift, those that remain really tend to become crafts, and therefore the steelmaking bike is really craft art today, although they're completely pragmatic, you know, completely functional. And the reason, you know, I kind of got into this book too was to speak about the whole idea of the Japanese industry, how they basically established what Japan really created was inexpensive quality that had never really been part of the consumer market for that time. So that's a very critical aspect, because the reason they were able to make those inroads is because they were able to displace the medium and lower priced bikes from every other nation.
You know, I never thought of it that way.
Yeah, that was, you know, it's an interesting idea. I mean, it begins with I discuss it in the book, but the whole philosophy of quality became essential to the Japanese for a number of reasons. They were influenced by a number of important Americans like Deming and others, but when they rebuilt after World War II, the nation realized it had very little natural resource that they could just, you know, sell. So the Middle East is selling oil, or other countries are selling products that they can mine or manufacture, you know, from the environment itself. Japan didn't have that. So they kind of took the German approach of making quality to be, or value added to be, their force of industry. And the bicycle and the transistor radio were two things that really helped to launch that for them.
I can see that. So one of the first Japanese bikes that my store carried was Kabuki. Now, there were some others that came before that. Saito was one. But the Kabuki was really an unusually made bike. It certainly wasn't light. I can remember they were really heavy. They were
they are pretty heavy.
Yeah. They were what, die cast frames? Is that what I remember about them?
No, they were steel frames, but they had sort of what you could call, I guess, an injection molded or die cast lug.
Right. And, okay. The lugs.
And Saito is actually an exporter. So, you know, those were the Saito and the Kabuki were sort of almost the same thing. They were both Bridgestone. And, so Bridgestone basically was under the Kabuki name and was solely exported by Saito and company until later on when they began to also have models under their own name, the ones that Mr. Peterson made so famous. But Bridgestone was interesting too, because they were very cautious exporters. If you look at my rather weird table of contents, it's both a table of contents and a graphic that shows the number of exports in 80 and 81,
right,
which was a major revival year. I mean, there were other years of over a million exports, but 80 and 81 is one of those. And Bridgestone really pretty much was a very low volume exporter overall compared to their full manufacturing. They were the largest manufacturer in Japan.
I'm trying to remember the sequence, but Bridgestone, I guess Grant ran the U.S. part
right.
of Bridgestone. He was the one.
Right.
Okay. He was the importer here. Wow.
Bridgestone Cycles USA on the West Coast.
Yes. Right. You know, your book is filled with so many historical facts and great stories. Do you have a story that we might not know, my listeners might not know? I mean, I'll bet a lot of them still have a Japanese bike somewhere in their quote-unquote collections. Because,
yeah,
of course,
exactly.
The right number of bikes is N plus one, right?
Yeah. So yes, there's always room for one more bicycle.
Yes, there is.
I mean, at a certain point, you know, we also used to continually change out the rear cogs and always making little adjustments depending on the ride we were going to do. And then it sort of became easier just to have another bicycle. Today, the range, the gearing range is so wide, it's really not necessary to do that. But when there was, you know, fewer 10 speeds and 12 speeds, part of the fun was really swapping out cogs, swapping out derailleurs and chains, and putting racks on or off, or doing what you had to do for your type of ride you're undertaking.
You reminded
I
was just going to say, you reminded me of the freewheel boards we used to have.
Oh,
to do just that. Okay. So to build custom freewheels based on whatever you wanted to do, because these derailleurs would take such a wide range of gearing. I forgot all about that.
Well, that's also was part of Suntour's downfall. They were brilliant engineers, but they tend to over-engineer a little bit. Whereas Shimano very intelligently basically said, you know, keep to the group set. If you're in the 105 series, use 105 equipment, you know. Dura-Ace, use Dura-Ace. Suntour really bragged that all their equipment was sort of interchangeable, which they thought was an important marketing point. But it got very, very complex at the end. And the other problem they sort of got locked into is they had this magnificent rear cog that could be built for a 5, 6, or 7-speed cog. But you really had to know what you were doing. And the interchangeability took time because of the different types of spacers and stuff. And because those were uneven spacing, their AccuShift system was really much harder to manage. And those and other reasons were part of Suntour's downfall, I think.
Yeah. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with William Bevington. His new book, Japanese Steel, Classic Bicycle Design from Japan. Their photography is by Scott Ryder. We'll talk about Scott in a little bit. The book is really stunning. If you have any interest in steel Japanese bikes, or if you ever owned one, which you probably did, or rode one, which you probably did, you might still, this book is going to be wonderful for you. Talk to me a little bit about the two export groups, the JEX group and JBM groups. They're interesting in how they actually worked and why did they have them?
Oh, well, this gets a little bit into the weeds, but says something about Japan at that time, you know, because the U.S. was, well, we had many antitrust laws going on and conflicts between companies and issues of monopoly. Many of the things that were basically not legal in the United States were precisely the way Japanese went about trying to support their brand. And a lot of that actually involved in the beginning helping shops or manufacturers basically be organized so that there wasn't too much competition across the component makers. And my joke is there were three of everything. You know, there were three derailleur makers, three tire makers, you know, three chain makers. That's not entirely true, but it almost fell out like that. And they also had different trade groups to support their brands. And the most important one was probably in 1963. They had the Japan Sport Cycle Association. So the Japan Sport Cycle Association would basically work with all the manufacturers, you know, to put forward a good front for the Japanese and a good front in the manufacturing side. But with the growth of Suntour and the growth of Shimano, they clearly were competitors, and it was very hard to have them within the same group. So that's where these groups broke off, and then there were two groups. One was the Japan Bicycle Parts Manufacturers Export Association, that's JEX, and JBM was more simply Japan Bicycle Parts Makers. So those were the two groups. And there were others, basically those were called the Kansai 6 and the Kansai 5. And you can go even further because there were Tokyo groups called the Tokyo 8. There was the Chubu 6. So if you want to get down to the weeds, there are actually six different groups. But the two most powerful were the Kansai 5 and 6. And then the Kansai 5 was Shimano and their team. And then the JAX group was Suntour and their team. And again, without going into total minutia here, what is quite fascinating is Suntour really sort of kept with the program, and they worked together, and each manufacturer in the group was dedicated to generally only one component or two components. Suntour, of course, was the drivetrain. Sagina was the crankset. Dicomp was the brakes. Then Nankai was another braking system as well, but coaster brakes. And HKK, or Hokoku, were the chain makers. So that was their system. The JBM group from the beginning had overlap. Takagi and Shimano both made cranksets. Sakai Ringo made things that Shimano made. So it was a less diversified group in a sense. The brands themselves were more internally diversified. And as Shimano grew and really had a very strong vision of what their company could be, they swallowed up some of these other companies, or it just began to fall apart. So by the late 80s, or actually mid 80s, and sometimes some groups fell off in the 70s, it began to disintegrate. JEX remained together longer until it just sort of ended more abruptly with the end of Suntour.
It's interesting. There was this rumor going around, whether it's true or not, that before he died, one of the Shimano people said he wanted to see Suntour gone. I don't remember if that was really true or not.
I don't know if I heard that exact quote, but it got pretty competitive. I mean, yeah. One of the more famous stories is the incredible, you know, SIS, when Shimano really got that index shifting perfectly down, they really had to use Suntour's patent to do it. They really had to use the slant parallelogram system. So what they did at the sort of famous bike show in Nevada, the international show that was done in Nevada, they covered the components up with black cloth. And the very night Shimano's patent ran out, they released the line.
You mean Suntour's patent?
Yeah, when Suntour's patent ran
out.
Right.
Yeah.
That night, Shimano unveiled their SIS. So, you know, it was really an incredible story, but it sort of speaks to this idea. And another area, again, kind of detailed area, is there's something called the Beast. Some of your listeners might know about it. It's actually a brilliant technology that doesn't use a front derailleur, but uses sort of a train track logic where one quarter of the chain ring is hinged. And it just moves left or right to bring you to the higher or lower gears on a triple crankset. It is so impeccably smooth. It is an incredible system. And it was invented by Browning. I think I'm right about that. I hope I'm right. And they brought that to both Shimano and to Suntour. And Suntour felt it was brilliant technology, and it was. I mean, what let it down was more the plastic system that was used for the electrics for it, you know, that wasn't as robust as it should have been, but in hindsight I could say that. But the system itself was impeccably designed, and they bought that system. It was very expensive. When they showed it to Shimano, he said, if we want this, we'll make it ourselves.
Right. You know? That's so Shimano. It's so Shimano.
But I mean, they did the right thing. I mean, I think you look at Shimano today; it's just such an amazing company. Really, I think their vision has been consistent and strong from the outset.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with William Bevington. He's the author of the new book, Japanese Steel: Classic Bicycle Design from Japan, and we'll be talking about what happened to all these beautiful Japanese bikes. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist, and we are going to continue our conversation with William Bevington about his new book, Japanese Steel.
So why do you think Japanese bikes fell out of favor. So now you have the Trex and you have the, I mean, I know that some of it has to do financially, but you had Nishiki and you had, which was really a West Coast Cycle product, as I remember.
That's right.
And
yeah.
Fuji.
Nishiki and Centurion were both really American driven firms, and all the others, Araya, Bridgestone, Panasonic, Miata, of course, Fuji, they were, you know, Japanese centric.
But what happened?
Well, I wouldn't really say, I mean, everything fell out of favor. So basically what happened was by the 80s, there were really maybe five or six or seven factors. So one was that the oil price shocks, you know, the various oil shocks, as they're called, really every time that would double and sometimes triple the cost of fuel. And that was a, those were very hard hits for Japan. There's the story of Schwinn. When they went, you know, to Japan, many, many, many Schwinns were Panasonics. I mean, Panasonic built a tremendous number of Schwinns and the classic kind of steel bike lugged frame models. And, you know, one day they went to a meeting, they sat down and they discussed the price for next year's model. And everyone at the table knew it was untenable, that they, that was the end, just immediate ending of the order. So one thing was just, the cost advantage was one factor. Another factor was Taiwan, the growth of the Taiwanese industry, because the Taiwanese basically were able to very closely copy a lot of the Japanese patents, and not really legally, but that's what they did. I mean, the argument, of course, is the Japanese did that in the early part of the 50s and 60s, really. And so now, you know, what sort of went around came around. But then Japan was really very interested in the international idea of protecting intellectual property. They're very strong advocates for it. But Taiwan came in and became the next place where, you know, these prices could be, very low prices could be met. So that was another major factor. The other, I think, very important factor, of course, is the industry just began to change. So everything wasn't just a different kind of road bike, you know, for racing or touring, but really with the mountain bikes and BMX and ATVs and this whole new breed of bicycles completely sort of split up the industry. And at that point, you know, Japan didn't have the cost advantage anymore, and they were losing to some degree the technology advantage. So the sales were just beginning to sort of plummet. I actually have a little graph in the beginning that the one of the ministries of finance, you know, helped me on over there. And it really does show how they have this million exports just begin to drop off. It's come somewhat back now. Japan actually manufactures and ships out quite a few bicycles today. But I think there's another factor that people don't discuss too much, which is the incredible aspect of what a good bicycle is, how it is not, has no built-in obsolescence. I mean, basically all you have to replace is the handlebar tape, you know, and the tires, right?
So yeah, well, tires, things, cables, and tape. That's right.
Right, that's it. That's nice. Some a little ditty. Tires, cables, and tape. But what happens is, as you mentioned, I see all the time, I take little snapshots of all these chained up S10Ss and 40 and now becoming 50-year-old bicycles,
right,
on the streets of New York. And New York is an incredibly tough environment on everything. And these things are such survivors. So I think another important and often overlooked aspect was that you only had to buy one bicycle, you know, for your, the whole time. So the market just got very saturated.
Talk to me a second about your photographer, Scott Ryder. The photography in the book is stunning. Everything about the book is stunning. It's beautifully, well, you're a designer. You're a graphic designer. It is a beautifully designed book. I love it.
Thank you so much. Some people complain a little bit about, you know, the small type and things like that, but I was really having fun. I wanted to...
It's not that small. I'd say it's probably 11 point, 10 point.
Oh yeah, the general reading type. But I have some lovely little miniature captions here and there.
Yeah, get your cheaters out, you know.
Yeah, right. But there was a logic for that. I mean, the entire thing is written to fit. Everything was written to fit. So basically, every page was designed kind of organically, and you know, I think there's just about 50,000 words in the book and just tons of research. I had no idea really of what I would get into on the book. We were about a year late. People know that they saw the date move along, you know, will be shipped in April, will be shipped in March, you know, will be shipped in June,
yep,
will be
yep.
shipped in September. But we pulled it off for the spring, so I was happy about that.
Well, it's a 240-page book.
Yeah, and I was originally going to make it a little longer, and the publisher was like, you're out of your mind, you know. So I said, okay, we'll pull back. But let me get to Scott. Scott and I actually met over purchases on eBay back in the days when you really communicated with people. I mean, now eBay is it's so seamless, you know, and totally electronic. But in the old days of eBay, you actually would just get people's addresses and send them checks and talk to them on the phone. And Scott and I sort of met that way because he was restoring, I believe, a Fuji Ace. So that's how we met. And then we formed sort of a little Google group of 5, 6, 7 Fuji and Japanese cycle aficionados. And then the book came about, there's kind of two stories. One was I was challenged to do it several years ago and said eventually I would do this. But the other reason was I was presenting another book to another editor at Zoli. And when I went to that meeting, I was riding one of this black professional. It's a one-off and just really beautiful bike. And I began to speak to that editor about this incredible bicycle. And then she said, oh, you should meet Jacob because he edits some really beautiful books on, that Rizzoli's done on bicycles. The incredible ones that Jan Heine wrote, you know, the two of them, which are great. And then he has the other one that he did, I think, self-published. But he has those two magnificent volumes. And actually, I followed the same size of books. I thought it would be, you know, great as a series. Anyhow, that's sort of how we got to it. And then Scott was always has been a photographer his whole life. I think he started in fashion design and then he worked in product design. He has a couple sites now where he photographs, usually in black and white, actual cycling events, particularly cyclocross. So he does some beautiful work that way. So we had met several times before and we actually kind of custom built this space just to shoot the bikes. We began in Manhattan, but it was very costly. We couldn't, you know, control the space like we wanted to. So during the time of this bicycle, the studio came along with it. It's very, very frightening because when we started, it was an unheated space. And the first bicycle, which I think is the Fuji newest, we shot, it was about 15 below zero.
Surprised the camera worked.
Oh, I mean, we were just barely functioning. I mean, fingers were frozen and it had a gravel floor. So if you dropped anything, it was pretty much lost. So that's how we began. By the end of it, it was, you know, a very swelteringly hot space. We did sort of a custom lighting. That was really an exciting part of the book of how the lighting was done. And that's John Hurley. So John Hurley did the lighting, indoor lighting, and Scott did the photography. And we tried to have some innovation in the way we did it. The bicycles were all supported by nylon filament, so we could get we could sort of really control the shadows. But there was a very kind of dedicated sense Scott had for how shadow worked, always with a highlight of 100% light. And then we used this incredible macro lens at a distance that would give us really strong depth of field shift. And that was very important to me. I really wanted to always just have only one part of the photograph, super crisp. And the huge files. I mean, I think Dropbox made more money than anyone on this project.
Can you tell we're talking with a designer here? I'm talking still with William Bevington about his new book, Japanese Steel, Classic Bicycle Design from Japan. I have just a couple of more questions before I let you go, and we'll let listeners know how they can get a copy of the book. You are seeing it if you're on Facebook or on Twitter or on Instagram. People are getting their copies, and it's popping up. It's a beautiful book. I had a question about a bike that isn't mentioned in your book and whether you know about it, called Zebra Kanko.
Oh, yes, I do know about that brand. We had to make some tough choices. I actually mentioned the bike several times, but it's not one of the dedicated sections.
Okay.
What my goal was, well, it was a moving target. So when we began the book, actually, it's kind of a fun little story. So when we began the book, I thought I'll just do my collection of 35, bikes. And I realized that wasn't going to work because there's a different sort of DNA to each manufacturer. And I realized that's not the best way to do a book like this. It's too really self-serving. I thought the best thing to do is to look at the field as if I were more the way I do research as a designer for other projects. So I took the 10 highest manufacturers. That was my sort of idea. That 1980 year is the midpoint of the boom. I went from 64, the Tokyo World's Fair, the invention of the Shinkansen, and Naeda's invention of the slant parallelogram derailleur. So 64 is a epochal year. And then I went up to about 95 when, by that time, most of the manufacturers were pulling out. Many have survived, but they were pulling out. So I just took these top 10. That was the idea. It took really months to get the list of bicycles I wanted shot. I wanted to do 100 bikes in the beginning, which made the book twice the size. The concept was, because this is so exciting, I would reach out, find people through all the various networks who had the bike, had them prep, make sure that bike was factory spec, get it to New York. We would set it up, shoot it, and I would return the bike. But actually, only one person did that. So instead, every single bicycle had to be purchased, prepped, and made correct to factory specs.
It's interesting that you had the factory specs for all of them.
It took some time, but we had them, except for one or two. I had very accurate factory specs, even stuff from the factories, not just the catalogs. But I had a lot of documentation, the internal documentation and memos and stuff, yeah.
Well, the book is stunning, just stunning. Once again, it is Japanese Steel. Where can listeners get a copy? It's from Rizzoli. That's the press. It's William Bevington and Scott Ryder, writer and photographer.
Well, if you just do the word Japanese Steel and Bevington, you'll find it from all different booksellers around the world. I think Amazon has it at like $32, and they've already sold out of their first two lots. So doing fairly well. I'm happy about that.
You think?
And, I actually, if any readers get to you and they find any typos or errors, I've found all the typos, there's 4 or 5, but any factual errors would be nice to know because we'll probably do a second printing. It's my chance to get everything perfect.
Here's my thing about typos. When I used to produce in the days when you would send newsletters out, as opposed to doing everything online with email and whatever, I would purposely put at least one or two typos in because then I knew people were actually reading it.
Okay.
And there were certain customers who always would say, "Hey, there's a typo." And I'm like, "At least I know you're reading it." So sometimes I did it on purpose. Just a little hint there.
Okay. Well, there's 6 typos in the book. And I think we've caught them all. But,
okay.
That's not bad out of 50,000. Two of them are with the misspelling of Marushi, so I have it correct usually, but once I transposed 2 letters on it, what I'm also searching for is any factual errors, but I probably shouldn't do this because I'll get myself in trouble.
Yeah, exactly. exactly.
Yeah.
Well, William, thank you so much for telling us about the book. I think it'll be a great gift if people are interested in putting something new on their bookshelf. If you have a Japanese steel bike, if you ever rode a Japanese steel bike, this book will tell you all about it. I certainly was a dealer for several of these brands, Fuji and Bridgestone. I was not a Nishiki dealer, but Miata, we had a huge Miata dealer here in Northeast
Miata's
Ohio.
Miata is one of the greats.
I see the bikes on the road, so they last a long time. Thank you so much. I hope you have lots of luck with the book, and I'll look for the second edition because I'll look through this one. And don't tell me where these typos are. I'll go look for them.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks.
Well, thank you so much, Diane. It's a pleasure speaking to you.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. William Bevington joined me from the Parsons School of Design in New York City.
If you're interested in a copy of the book, Japanese Steel, you can order it online from the publisher, Rizzoli, or from the other usual places. That's our show for this week. I hope you enjoyed my conversations with both Tim Blumenthal and William Bevington. We'll be back next week with a new event on Cape Cod, a discussion about tariffs and manufacturing with Zach Pashak from Detroit Bikes, and more. Remember, you can join the conversation or start a new one on our Facebook page. Send us a tweet at Outspoken Cyclist without an E, or leave a comment on our blog, OutspokenCyclist.com. As always, thank you so much for listening. I hope you have a great week. Stay safe out there, and remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on the Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.